Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm James Hattori, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. 4.5 years after the U.S. invasion, Iraq is still a very long way from the democratic ideal Americans once envisioned. A large but seldom told part of that story is the exodus of Iraq's professional class. Today we're joined by three Iraqi scholars, an archaeologist, an English professor, and a political scientist. All have fled Iraq, trying to start a new life while looking over their shoulders at what has become of their country. This hour On Point, three Iraqis on the country they left behind. And joining me now from Long Island, New York, is Donnie George. He left Iraq in August 2006 and has been teaching Asian and Asian American studies at Stony Brook University since the fall of 2006. While he was in Iraq, he was director general of the Iraqi National Museum, also president of the Iraq Antiquities Board and lecturer in archaeology at Baghdad University. Welcome, Donnie George.
Thank you very much.
With me in the studio today is Abdul Sattar Jawad. He was in Iraq. He left in 2005 in June. He's currently a visiting professor of English at Harvard. He is a former editor of the English language Iraqi newspaper, the Baghdad Mirror, and former dean of the College of Arts at Al-Mustan Saria University in Baghdad. He was also chair of the English department at Baghdad University. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from London is Saad Jawad. He left Baghdad in October of this year and is currently a researcher working at the University of Exeter in Devon, England. He was a longtime professor of political science at Baghdad University, specializing in Kurdish issues. Hello to you, Saad.
Hello to you.
Great. Let's start with you. You left, when did you leave exactly, and what were the circumstances? Why did you leave?
Is that to me?
Yes, Saad.
Yeah. Well, I waited all these years hoping that things would improve, but things didn't, unfortunately, as I was expecting, and threats were increasing, and killing of my colleagues and fellow colleagues and students was also increasing. So I had no alternative but to take a leave and leave Iraq.
Were you physically threatened, or did you feel you were in danger?
I felt at times in danger, in great danger, actually, because of the sectarian militia and because of my secular views. And I was threatened, my son was threatened, and I had to leave.
Donnie George in Long Island, what about the circumstances of your leaving Iraq?
Well, it looks like the same like my colleague Saad, because, again, my son was threatened. He was living with my parents in Dora, which is, till now, one of the dangerous parts of Baghdad. And I had a lot of pressure in my position because we belonged to a ministry that actually was belonging to al-Sadr party. So since my son was threatened, a very serious threat, and at first I had to send them to Damascus, then with all the pressure that I had in my office with the minister, I applied for retirement, and my application was signed and approved in 2 hours. So he was expecting, with all that pressure he was putting on me. So unfortunately, I really had the idea of sending my family to be much more safe in Damascus and staying in my position and doing whatever I could. But having all that pressure on me, and I noticed that they wanted me to leave. And this was something that is actually happening all the time. If they put pressure on you and you don't leave, then you will be put online. This means that you will be assassinated in any time.
And Sattar Jawad here in Boston, you were a publisher of an English language newspaper in Baghdad. That made you an especially big target, didn't it?
I was the editor of the Baghdad Mirror, the only English language, and it was targeted by the insurgent. It was a narrow escape for me. the insurgent bombed the Baghdad Mirror office in Al Masbah area.
They bombed your office?
Yeah, just 5 minutes after leaving my office, and I was alerted by the ABC. They were very close to my office, and they asked me, "Where are you now?" I told them, "I'm on my way home." They said, "Your office is burning. We could see the smoke coming out."
Had you received threats prior to that?
Yes, I received a threat, but I ignored them before that because I published advertisement for the American Army. They were not editorial, not columns, but advertisement.
What? Tell us a little bit about what being a professor, you were also a professor as well, at Baghdad University was like then. After the invasion occurred, did classes and studies continue as normal?
Not really. After the invasion, you see, there was great damage on the libraries, the labs, the buildings, the electricity, the infrastructure, and even transportation at that time. But we tried after 1 month to resume teaching in our classes on whatever basis possible. And we tried hard, and I came to the United States in April 2004 lobbying for books. And I told our colleagues here in the Congress, please flood the country with books. We don't want the turbans to intervene in our daily life, in our universities.
The turbans?
The turbans. Our country is overruled by a forest of turbans. The campuses are overruled by them.
Are you talking about fundamentalists?
Yes, sure.
Yeah. Donnie George, tell us a little bit about academic freedom and what that was like in Iraq.
Well, if I may speak, before 2003, it was... Yes, it was controlled by Saddam and Ba'athists, but of course it was much more free than now. After 2003, I did not have chance to teach in the university. I used to go and come from my position. But I do have a lot of connections with friends and colleagues in the universities. And let me tell you one thing. One of my friends told me that he has collected all his classes in one day only. And then afterwards he goes home and he never goes out. And even in those classes, he would say almost 50% of the students come and show. Again, as my colleague said, it's the intervention of the turbans all around and the students who are actually members of these sectarians and religious parties. Students want to control the whole system of the universities.
Saad, can you tell us, you were there most recently, how many of your colleagues did you see either killed or I imagine that probably the vast majority were at least threatened?
Well, I lost count of the people killed. I mean, every day we hear somebody, either a colleague in the same college or in the same university or from other universities. The number officially now is exceeding 250 professors that killed from the University of Baghdad and other Iraqi universities in Baghdad, not all over Iraq. So mm-hmm. I think the number is over 1,000 if we count those over Iraq. And the other thing is that the problem, as you were asking about what sort of freedom we used to have, at that time, in, before 2003, we used to fear one person, that is the president. We could not touch him or speak about him. Now, we cannot know who is the dangerous element. A small student from the militia could get you killed in 1 second if he is dissatisfied with what you say. There is no court, no police station, nobody to complain to, nobody to go to and say, this gentleman or this man has threatened me or is terrorizing me. This is the chaos that the British and American occupation has created in Iraq and in the universities as well.
Sattar Jawad, there probably were many forces at play in terms of the intimidation and the attacks on the professors. You can't pin it on just one group or one rationale behind it, can you?
Well, as Saad told you, you see, there were bullying students, fanatic students, and firebrand clerics who incited students to dominate and intimidate the professors and kill them.
Was that to muzzle your academic independence?
Of course, of course. This is not there is no possibility to teach in such chaotic, dangerous climate, you see.
What was it they opposed, they were objecting to, that you taught?
Well, first of all, they target the intellectuals, the professors, because they don't share them with their values. Secondly, they want to impose their own values by canceling classes and injecting the syllabi with the new controversial topics. So they want to...
More religious-oriented, you mean?
More religious, more historical, you see. There is no teaching, no academic freedom, and I have been told that they force the degrees also. And they are joining PhD programs, MA programs, without being qualified. Or their degrees were not being attested by the Ministry of Higher Education. So it is chaotic situation in our campuses, and still the militia are roaming the corridors of our campuses.
The militia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Donnie George, what kind of teaching experience was it like for you after the invasion and occupation?
As I said, I did not go back to the Department of Archaeology after 2003 because I was so much busy in rehabilitating the museum and the whole system of antiquities. But let me say something about the whole what's happening. Let's say it. Let's say the truth.
We just have a few seconds left here. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's exactly what had happened in Iran, and they are doing the same thing. These people are directed and pushed by Iran, and they are doing the same thing for the intellectual people in Iraq, exactly what happened to Iran.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with three Iraqi intellectuals about why they left their country and their thoughts about their country today. We're talking with Donnie George. He left Iraq in August 2006 and has been teaching Asian and Asian American studies at Stony Brook University since the fall of 2006. While in Iraq, he was director general of the Iraqi National Museum. And we're also talking with Abdul Sattar Jawad. He left Iraq in June 2005. Currently, he's a visiting professor of English at Harvard University. He's a former editor of the English-language Iraqi newspaper, the Baghdad Mirror. And we're also talking with Saad Jawad, who left Baghdad just this past October. He was a longtime professor of political science at Baghdad University, specializing in Kurdish issues. Saad Jawad, what was it like for the university to, and for the country at large, for that matter, to lose so many academics? Is there a brain drain, and what effect does that have on the country?
If you could just leave me 1 second to comment on something. Do you know that in the House of Commons in Iraq, out of the 376 people, representative of the Iraqi people, the government say that there are 90% of them with no education at all, and they have presented false certificates of PhD and MSc and MA degrees and BA degrees for themselves, and they are still in the commons. Nobody touched them. This is to start with. The second problem is that as soon as the occupation took place, the American forces brought with them all these ex-Iraqis with all their tarnished reputation, with no education, some of them whatsoever, and imposed them in the government council of government and let them govern Iraq. So they are actually helping them to be the elite of Iraq on top of the real intellectual elite of the Iraqis. The third thing is, I never felt at any moment that the American administration in Iraq was so interested in keeping the education or the university system going. The universities were looted, and people were kidnapped, threatened, and killed, and the drainage started right from the beginning. In 2003, many doctors, medical doctors and professors were kidnapped, either killed or were threatened to be killed, and they made to pay very big ransom and leave Iraq. So I think there was a plan by some organization or by some interested governments in the area or outside the area to drain Iraq of all the brains they had, because they know, as Mrs. Madeleine Albright said, that we have destroyed the Iraqi ability to manufacture weapons of mass destructions, but the brains are still there. So it was obvious that they came for the brains, and there was a plan to drain this country of these brains.
Well, that's quite a conspiracy theory. I'm not sure that
not a conspiracy
everyone would
theory,
agree with you. No.
Excuse me. You don't have to comment of what I'm saying. This is my point of view. If you go to the Security Council, you will see the declaration of Mr. Bush and Mrs. Albright. They were there, and they said these words. Thank you very much.
All right. But can you tell us, Donnie George, about the effect overall of this exodus of academics? And what does this say about the future for Iraq?
Well, I would say it is a catastrophe, because these are the people who are teaching the generations to come in Iraq. And if you don't have these intellectual people, these specialist people in all the fields, whatever they are, if you don't have them, so what kind of generations are you going to have? This kind of generation that these turbans are trying to impose for the country, it's a chaos now, and it looks like it will be a chaos at least for 10, 15 years to come.
Do you also blame the U.S. or the occupation forces, or for that matter, the new Iraqi government, for not taking a stronger hand in reforming or freeing, I guess, in this case, the university system now?
Well, let me say something. These people were allowed, they were given green light to come from the neighboring countries, mainly from the east, from Iran. Most of them were stationed or based there. So they were given the green light to come in the country together with their militias. Thousands of militias armed completely came in from the eastern neighbors. So this was something, I would say, that the American administration had participated in a way or another. They did not stop them. Now, they are helping them in the name of democracy, which is, I would say, in a good faith, yes, to help the Iraqi people. But who are these people that are named, between brackets, the Iraqis? These are not, I would say, in one big word, these are not the good Iraqi people. It's a kind of chaos that these people are bringing. It's a kind of situation that these people are bringing that will affect the future of the country, maybe, as I said, 10, 15, or maybe 20 years.
Sattar Jawad, did you support the invasion and occupation?
Not really, no. We wanted to kick Saddam out, but not in this way, you see. We wanted a change, but it was a flawed strategy. And as Saad and Danny said, you see, after the invasion, immediately the secular people were ignored, the middle class was ignored, the intellectuals were marginalized, and the country was left in the hand of idiot people. That's why we have dysfunctional government now. The problem is with the Iraqi government, which is not governing, you see. It cannot protect itself, the campuses, the faculties. Partly, they subscribe to the killing of the professors themselves.
Let's open up the conversation now and go to the callers. Ward is in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Hi, Ward.
Yeah, hi, James. Thanks for taking my call. Some of my question was just answered. I was curious, with the weapons of mass destruction being scoffed at now on the American public, and the way the U.S. invaded and the reasons for invasion, I'm just curious with the intellectuals we have here in this conversation, what are their thoughts as far as the invasion? Is there anger towards the U.S.? Obviously, they're trying to portray, or we're trying to portray, that things are on the more of an up and up now with the surge in troop force. I'm just curious as to their feelings is there anger towards the United States for the way the country was invaded, or is that anger subsided in some ways now that the surge is working to some extent?
Saad Jawad, you were there most recently. I don't know if you saw the effect of the surge or not. Have things changed substantially? Are you angry at the U.S. for not doing more or changing the situation?
Well, I'll tell you something. Maybe you won't believe it, but this is the truth. I think At the beginning, 85% of the Iraqi people were happy to see the regime changing, the regime of Saddam Hussein changing. And they were really happy to see some changes happening in their life. But gradually, and day after day, they lost this hope and they lost this optimism, and they got very, very much angry with the United States policy in Iraq, because there was no policy at all, and the country was turned upside down without any changes and without any progress toward democracy or the respect for human rights. So I was angry right from the beginning. Actually, to tell the truth, I was against the invasion, because I always thought a country that influence or impose sanctions on people, helpless people, for 30 years and kill 1,800,000 people without no reason cannot do good for this country. This was my idea about the Americans, and proved to be right. And the Americans are not doing anything for my country at all. And I think American people are realizing that this lie about weapons of mass destructions and human rights and democracy proved to be a false allegation. And we are still waiting for something to happen. They have helped people from all sects, Kurds, Arabs, Sunnis, Shiis, Christians. All the bad guys from these sects were helped to come and be the governing elite of Iraq. All their tarnished reputation was erased, and they regarded whoever remained in Iraq as a stooge of Saddam Hussein, and he should not have any chance to rule the country. That's why the middle class, the intellectuals, were erased and put aside, and we had these people. And lately, I think everybody have heard about the minister the old minister of electricity, who was imprisoned in Iraq because of his misconduct, and the American forces kidnapped him from prison and put him back in the United States, where he lives freely with the millions he pinched. This is not the way to build a new country.
Well, as I'm sure you realize, many Americans share some frustration as well about what's going on in Iraq. And many of the facts and stories that you refer to have yet to be settled or established, but we'll go on. Nonetheless, Donnie George, do you plan to go back to Iraq at some point? You left in 2006. Is there hope that you can go back and reestablish your life as an academic?
Let me tell you one thing. Deep in my heart and my mind, I'm an Iraqi. I was born there. My ancestors are buried there. That's my country. Whenever I see a good chance and complete safety for my family, yes, I'll go back. But now I can't see it in the horizon because of what's happening. I regret to say that, but this is the reality. Yeah.
Sato Jawad, from what you know, what you've heard about what's going on in Baghdad, do you get the sense that things are truly better than they were immediately after the occupation and invasion?
Well, you see, I think there is improvement, you see, and the American General Petraeus is on the right track, but this came just a few months ago. It's too late after squandering blood and pressure on the Iraqis on the American side, you see. He needs time, he needs support, and the Iraqi issue shouldn't be a political game between the Democrats and the Republicans. We need to draft a new and forge a new strategy based on reality, the blunt reality, not on political issues and interests, you see. We need a place to help the moderate Kurd, moderate Shia, moderate Sunni to form a new government, representative government, regardless of their religious or sectarian background. Mm-hmm. The brain is on, and I heard, my friends know, Behnam Abusuf is going next week to join us here in Brown in Boston.
Who is coming? I'm sorry?
This is professor of archaeology, and he was the director. He's one of the great minds of the country.
One
he loves
colleagues.
Iraq. He loves his work, but he is forced to leave the country.
So it's still happening.
We talk about Sunni and Shia, and we ignore the other people. We want Iraq to be unified, run by people who love their country, not by a bunch of thugs.
Let's go back to the callers. John is on the line from Rockport, Massachusetts. Hi, John.
Hi.
What's your question?
I just want these fine people to know that I'm ashamed of my country, and I have tremendous compassion for what they've been through. I mean, for us to have the unmitigated arrogance to think that we can go all the way across the world to solve the problems of a country that we don't take the time to understand the culture of, the language of, and what the various issues of are, and we can't solve the problems here. I mean, it bothers me to such a degree. I'm embarrassed and ashamed of my country, and I grew up a very, very staunch American. I'm not a kid. I'm 60 years old, and I just want these people to know that I'm ashamed of my country, and I feel tremendous compassion for what they've been through.
John, thank you. Saad Jawad, are you at all surprised to hear a call like that?
Not at all. I've been to the United States lately, and I have met people with the same point of view, and I have met people who worked with the American administration there, and they are really regretting what they have done, and they were truly apologetic about whatever happened. You know, when you think of Mr. Garner coming to Iraq, who knows nothing about Iraq, who has nobody speaking Arabic in his team, when you think of Mr. Bremer coming there with nobody speaking Arabic, with nobody specialized in the Iraqi issue.
These are the first two administrators that were appointed to
run these are the administrative officers in Iraq. So what do you think? I mean, I am sure that most of the American people, sensible Iraqi American people, are of the same view as this right gentleman.
All right, let's go to another call, and let's talk with Joan from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Joan, are you there?
Hi, I'm here. I'm just calling to say how horribly upset and outraged I am to hear again this story, which I heard a little bit about. I mean, I heard quite a lot about it. And I just want to express to these very dignified gentlemen my sorrow and shame that my country did this to your country, and I hope someday maybe it can be corrected. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Joan. Donnie George, how has your experience coming to the U.S. been thus far? You're now at Stony Brook University in Long Island. Tell us about your welcome here.
You see, I've been here several times for conferences and lectures, but this time is the longest one. I'm over a year here. I have my family with me here. To tell you the truth, I have been hearing the same thing as the gentleman and the lady had said from around me all the time. People understand what's going on there, and they are wonderful people. We are having very, very good relations with Americans here. With my students, I teach two classes, and they are completely understanding what's going on. In fact, I'm teaching the roots of modern Iraq, which is we start from the beginning of the 20th century, and until now, we are following the news in Baghdad and other places and discussing them through an academic level. And I'm really so glad to hear some wonderful ideas from my students, exactly as these two, this gentleman and this lady.
Sattar Jawad, just briefly, we have about a minute left here in this segment. Do you have friends still in Iraq, in Baghdad, and what are they telling you about the situation? Is it getting better or worse?
I lost contact. It is getting better, but one has to be cautious, you see, because there is no representative government, there is no central government, and even now the Iraqis who wish to go back from Syria to Jordan to Iraq, they have been told by the Iraqi government to wait, we are not ready to receive you, but this is their country, and you can imagine.
They can't handle the influx of returning.
No, some people are afraid to register with the government. They will hand them in the hand of the militia.
And the university is the same situation?
Well, it's the same, you see.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about Iraq losing its professional class. We're talking with Donnie George. He left Iraq in 2006 and has been teaching Asian and Asian American studies at Stony Brook University. Also, Abdul Sattar Jawad, who left Iraq in June 2005, currently a professor at Harvard University, as well as Saad Jawad, who left Baghdad in October this year. He was a longtime professor at Baghdad University, specializing in Kurdish issues. Let's go to the callers right now, and Kyla is on the line from Oxford, Iowa. Hi, Kyla.
Hi, James, gentlemen. Considering that the Bush war has destroyed Iraq and probably set the country back 50 years, and it's likely that women will never get their rights back, is there anything that anyone can do to make things less bad? What would you recommend be done?
Thank you, Kyla. Let's at this point, we're going to bring in one other guest, and that is John Aker, who joins us from London as well. He is a professor of refugee studies at London South Bank University. He's also executive secretary of CARA, the Council for Assisting Refugee Academics, which has operated out of London since 1933. Good day, Mr. Aker.
Good day, James. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Did you hear the question? Maybe you can weigh in a little bit.
Yeah, I think, can I firstly say what an interesting program it is, and I congratulate the three guests for being very articulate on their points. We're helping at the moment over 100 Iraqi academics in various countries in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt, Jordan, and in the United States. And we've got a lot of sympathy for the plight they're in. I think the main strain at the moment is that it's certainly anti-intellectual as far as the new government in Iraq is concerned. And we think that in answer to your last question, that what needs to be done is the whole academic world ought to come to the rescue of our Iraq colleagues. Colleagues in America, Britain, and Europe have got absolute sympathy. And through my organization, CARA, and Scholars Rescue Fund, and the Scholars at Risk Network in the United States, we're putting forward programs to help Iraqi scholars. We don't want them to not to leave their country forever, but what we want to do is to keep their brains intact for the future. That's what we want to do, and we've got big programs for that. But we want to convince the American public, the British public, the European public, to bring pressure on their governments to help Iraqi academics at this present time.
Mr. Aker, is it your experience that or knowledge that what's happening with the intellectuals in Iraq is a concerted effort or even conspiratorial in terms of their being targeted?
I've got great sympathies for the views which have been expressed that all the factions in and religious orders in Iraq want to drive out the intellectuals. All the information that we have indicates, and I've just returned from Syria, where I saw it firsthand, really leading professors at Baghdad University saying they had to get out because their sons and daughters were being threatened with kidnap. And it is obvious to me that there is the bones there of a concerted and united action against intellectuals to drive them out. And you may call that a conspiracy, you may call it other things, but there is, it's too much of an accident that's occurring. And one other thing I would say to you, I was with the UN, UNHCR in Damascus, only 3 weeks ago, and they were saying to me that the number of intellectuals coming from Iraq are increasing, not decreasing.
All right, let's go to the phone calls right now, and Jim is on the line from Boston. Hi, Jim.
Hi, James. I actually am calling because I, in 2005, was imprisoned in the Kurdish region in the north, and my question is for the Kurdish expert. I'm curious to know if in the north things are different for academics and if there's any place to go in Iraq that is different, since I know that Iraq is so divided as far as cultural and social norms.
Jim, you were in the military?
No, actually. I'm a civilian. I and a friend went from Turkey, and we were imprisoned in on our entry. And actually, it's another point that I wanted to make, but I didn't want to take up too much time.
Sure.
But just that, you know, the governments are an added element that nobody really is reporting on, the fact that the governments are, in their way of distributing security, they're, you know, pretty much kidnapping people and imprisoning people on both the Iraqi side and the American side. And I think, you know, our real security issue is more civil liberty than anything.
Saad Jawad in London, you specialized in Kurdish studies at Baghdad University. Maybe you can answer some of his concerns.
Well, yes, partially in the north of Iraq, the situation is better, quieter, and safer. Partially, I should say, and repeat. But things are not that better at all, because for an Arab professor from the rest of Iraq to go there, he needs a special permission and a special security permission. And in my experience, there were 10 or 12 people who were threatened from Iraq, from the rest of the Iraqi universities, to get killed, and were receiving these threats. And they went and met the president of the republic, that Mr. Talbani, and he promised them to take them to Sulaymaniyah University, and this never happened. And for an Iraqi to go there is like going to a foreign country. Short of a visa, he needs to take a permission to stay there, and this permission is limited for time. But I should again repeat, situation there is quieter, and the security situation is better than in the rest of Iraq.
John Acker, can you give us a little better idea? We're talking about intellectuals today, but obviously the exodus of refugees is a lot bigger than that. Give us a sense of how big it is, and maybe whether it's being affected by what's going on the ground in Iraq now, whether the surge has made a difference in that flow.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this point, James, because I was trying to get exact figures when I went to Syria, because Syria is really important for understanding the issues, because a lot of Iraqis is probably the chief destination of where Iraqis go to flee from. And interestingly enough, the Syrian authorities have made an exception that the academics, and my understanding is that academics do not need a visa to get into the country, whereas for the general population from Iraq, it's not true. The UNHCR indicated that to me that there were nearly 1.75 million of people of Iraqis in Syria. And that is a tremendous number for the Syrian authorities to cope with. But their latest figures, and this is astonishing, and this was astonishing for UNHCR, because they're not used to these kind of figures. They said that on the survey which they'd recently completed, that 19%, James, of the people were coming from Iraq into Syria who had first degrees or higher than first degrees. And this means that literally the really highly trained young people and older people are getting out of Iraq. And it's witness to what has already been said, that it may be for some people getting better in Iraq, but there's lots of occupations who feel uncomfortable about being in Iraq. The doctors, the dentists, the engineers, the academics, and the middle classes feel very uncomfortable about it being Iraq. And the other thing that your three guests haven't said, but is absolutely true, these people that are getting out of the country have had very good jobs. They've had possessions. They've had not only property, but they've had other wealth. And I'm not saying that's university so, but it's certainly for a vast number of people. And they feel that there is no alternative other than to actually get out of the country. And it's like a huge sadness that they have are leaving the country and everything that they've worked for. And lots of those people now have moved to Syria and are literally running out of money. And there is a huge problem in Syria at the moment with the number of Iraqis there who are living on savings. Many of them are our academics, who are finding it immensely difficult to actually kind of get any kind of living at all.
John Acker, at this point, we're going to thank you for helping us out here and your insight, and have a good day.
Thank you very much, James.
All right.
James, if you excuse me, I want to add something about your question to John Eckert. When I was in Damascus, Iraqi specialists, doctors, and physicians founded a complete College of Medicine in Damascus, with all staff coming from Iraq. Imagine a complete College of Medicine in Damascus, completely with the staff coming from Iraq.
That's how many people have left, yeah.
You see?
Incredible.
In this field, only in this field. So it is a real tragedy.
Let's take another call. Tom is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Tom.
Hi, James. Thank you for accepting my call. I've been listening to this, and I'm a little upset. First of all, life under Saddam Hussein was not that great for many, many Iraqis. And we did free the country, whether it was right or wrong, indifferent, but we did. Now it's up to the Iraqis to fight for their country and to get their government going. And by these people, these scholars, leaving their country, I mean, I would fight for America to the day I die. I'm not going to about to leave my country and let these thugs from other countries come in and run their country. They're blaming the United States for not forming their government, for not unifying Iraqis, but yet they'll run. I just don't understand it, and I'm sorry. And I'll accept their response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Saad Jawad, your response?
Yes, well, I'm amazed about this logic. I think if you are threatened and there is somebody who is supported by the biggest power in the world is threatening you, and you get killed, and your family is gets the same destiny, I cannot see why on earth I should stay unarmed and as an intellectual and fight for myself or my kids. I mean, would he do that if his country is occupied? This is the first issue. The second issue, I don't know who asked the United States to come and liberate us from what we were living under. We were complaining, we were the opposition inside, we were doing all what we can to change things or to at least improve things. We did not want the Americans, even the United Nations did not want the American or permit give the permission to the United States to come and liberate our country in this way. This is a strange logic I cannot accept. But anyway, if you see the number of people killed under the occupation and the money, the amount of money wasted under the occupation, I cannot see how you can defend such stupid policy.
Well, Mr. Saad Jawad, do you as an Iraqi feel a responsibility to help your country to become whole again now?
Well, I am responsible. I am doing what I can for my country from abroad and inside. I lived in my country under the threats for 4 years and a half. And to tell you some other things, I lived in my country during the Iraq-Iran war and during the war of Kuwait and all these sanctions. I lived there and my family was living in dangers all the time. And I forced my family to stay there in Iraq because I told them this is their country. But at that time, there was no threat on their lives. They were living in dire need for things. They were living in difficulties, but there was no threat on their lives. And I forced them. My late wife was always blaming me for leaving them to stay in Iraq all these years. But now I think nobody could blame me for taking them to the safety or to safety.
Mm. Sattar Jawad, do many Iraqis feel that many of their problems or the violence especially stems from the occupation? Obviously, there are many groups at work in Iraq, including various religious factions and guerrilla and simple criminals, for that matter.
Well, you see, the invasion is responsible for that. There was flawed policy, and I could tell the guy who raised this question, I'm here in the United States because you are there in my country and you rock the country, and I felt unsafe. You see, leaving a country is not easy. It's hard to breaking. When it is necessary, we decided to leave, you see. This is the problem, you see, but I'm praying for peace to prevail. I love my country. I love my student. I love my university.
Donnie George, did you want to weigh in on this?
Well, the same thing as these gentlemen have said. It's our country, but sometimes when it comes to the threatening of your own children to be killed or kidnapped and beheaded, there's nothing left just to leave and save them from this, even if it's your own country that is actually governed now by hooligans and governed now by criminals that are controlling the whole thing.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Saad Jawad, let me give you just a few seconds at the end here to say what you think Americans should know about what's going on in Iraq, and especially with the elite intellectual class that is forced to leave at this point. Saad?
Yes, I should think every United States citizen should know that their government, their policy have turned a country into chaos, and that their lack of policy, I should say, was the reason for all these atrocities we are living under. The best advice to give to their government is to get rid of the bad guys or the ex-Iraqis, I should tell, call them, who have been squandering the money of the Iraqi state and killing people. Get them out and send them to where they came from and live those Iraqis, the intellectual Iraqis, the good Iraqis who lived in Iraq, who know their country, to rebuild their country. We don't need the assistance of the United States because we have experienced this assistance for 4 years and a half.
And let me allow Sattar Jawad just a couple of seconds to finish up here.
Well, I would like to say that you have to fix it before you leave Iraq. You have undone this, you see, the country, and you have to fix it before leaving it.
And Donnie George?
Well, I would say the same thing. You know, going to into a country and mix everything, it's a great responsibility for the United States to fix it.
Well, gentlemen, all three of you, thank you very much for your comments and your time, and we wish you the best of luck. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website. That's onpointradio.org. I'm James Hattori, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.